You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and We Saw the Devil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. It's Robin, and I am on my own for this episode. As we stated in the last couple episodes, I will be moving back to Nashville, Tennessee, because of my parents. And, you know, an update on that. First of all, thank you so much for all of the kind wishes and thoughts. So many of you have been so kind and reached out and sent us emails, and it is so greatly appreciated. You have absolutely no idea. I will be returning to Nashville, Tennessee on Monday, finalizing the pod, getting everything, a house packed up on almost zero notice. It has been a lot. So for this episode, we promised you a true crime road trip, picking basically a case from the route that we will be taking. We've already done, if you're a Patreon patron, we have actually already covered a case from Portland, Oregon, and that one was particularly close to our hearts as it was done on Sarah Zagul. And Sarah was one of Jackie's closest friends, and she was brutally murdered in 2018. A lot of you may be familiar with the case. She was murdered, dismembered, and it made international news all over the world. We have already done a Portland, Oregon case, so we decided that we would actually start just across the bridge, a couple miles away in Vancouver, Washington, which is just a couple miles away from Portland. So for this episode, we will be telling the story of serial child rapist and murderer with cannibalistic fantasies, Wesley Allen Dodd. On July 3rd, 1961, Wesley Allen Dodd was born to Jim and Carol Dodd in rural Washington, and he was the oldest of three children. Later in life, Wesley would give contradictory statements regarding his family life. So he first said that he had a decent home life, although his parents were not really affectionate, they were cold. He never heard the words, "I love you," and had never actually said them himself throughout his entire life. Later, while he was in prison, he ended up writing at length that his father was mentally, physically, and emotionally abusive with him. So it's unknown which version of events is true. Dodd's brother was born when he was just 1 year old, and he admitted that he would help bathe his little brother and he would sleep beside him. And he would continue bathing his little brother until he was 7 years old and sleeping with him in the same bed until they were 10 and 9 respectively. When Wesley was 3, his little sister was born. Now, Wesley Allen Dodd's first sexual experience took place when he was just 8 years old. One night, while at a sleepover at a cousin's house, they mutually masturbated and touched each other's genitals. And that was the first sexual contact that he had with another human being. He would frequently urinate on himself in situations of embarrassment. So when he was preparing to leave to have his tonsils removed as a child, his mom was trying to get him ready to go and get dressed. He urinated on himself out of embarrassment. His mom apparently reprimanded him. He wasn't the easiest to deal with child. And so he would be reprimanded, you know, as a parent. And one time he was with a group of family members and she said something to him and he urinated in front of himself. So he was easily embarrassed. And that would later on include teasing or rejection. After his eventual arrest, he admitted to police that one of the most pivotal moments of his entire life took place when he was around 10 years old. He exposed himself to a young neighbor girl, and she was completely and utterly disgusted by him. She screamed, told him to pull up his pants, and refused to look at him. And he later claimed that the event affected his sexuality and sexual preference, and that was the moment that he started preferring boys. As Wesley entered middle school, he was teased mercilessly and became a complete loner. He was soft-spoken, slightly effeminate, and his classmates all assumed that he was gay, and they bullied him relentlessly for it. Male classmates would pretend to like him, flirt with him, ask him to do things like masturbate or shower with them, and then when Wesley would show any sort of interest in doing that or be okay with it, the boys would then laugh and then run and tell all of the rest of their classmates, and that cycle would actually continue. By the age of 13, Wesley was now exposing himself to neighborhood children. He first tried with girls, but they would run inside and tell their parents. He quickly realized that boys wouldn't. He could get away with it. They would just laugh or look at him shocked, but they wouldn't go in and report it or tell anyone. And he later estimated that he exposed himself to between 40 and 60 children just during those early teen years. He also accomplished this by asking kids if they wanted to see a trick. A classmate of his had a father who had to catheterize himself, and Wesley became infatuated with this and then started being a little bit too much like Albert Fish, and he began to insert needles and the points of pens into the head of his penis. And he would ride his bicycle up to a lone child, typically a boy, ask if he wanted to see a magic trick, and then expose himself while he stuck things into the head of his penis. So this was when he was around 13 and 14 years old, so already we had a lot of extreme behaviors going on there. His father was well aware of his son's extracurricular activities. He was well aware. He and Wesley apparently had a very honest relationship, almost like friends. They had frequent father-son talks, but he did nothing. Obviously, should have reported him to police or gotten him into intense psychological help or therapy, but he did not do it. He actually ignored it entirely. The age of 14 was very important in Dodd's life. He began to sexually molest his younger sister during this time. He would go into her bedroom at night and place her hand on his penis and then repeatedly try to have sex with her. She did always refuse it, and this never took place and it never happened. She also never reported it to their family, to their parents. Now, coming from a large family, he had many, many, many cousins. It was a very large extended family. And he immediately became sexual with all of his cousins. He had anal sex with one 8-year-old male cousin. He molested a 6-year-old female cousin and then had sex with her 6-year-old brother on the same day. As far as we know, none of these other children or family members reported it to police, their family, a counselor, a teacher. It went completely unreported. Now, it's also during this time that he started experimenting with bestiality and coprophagia, and he would spread his own feces all over his body and genitals and then initiate sexual contact with his family dog. Late into his 14th year, Wesley's parents separated and later divorced, and he was beyond emotionally starved, and he did not take it well. He really wanted, like I think a lot of children at that time, he wanted and desired that physical contact. In order to obtain that, he went to a local elementary school and asked 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls, he handpicked them if they would play a game with him. He then had them touch his genitals under the guise of a magic trick. And he later returned to the same elementary school and did it again. When he was 15, he was arrested for exposing himself, but instead of being prosecuted, was given mandatory counseling. He did, in fact, complete that counseling program. At the age of 16, he molested at least 20 additional children, ranging from the ages of 1 year old to 10. By 16, both of his parents were remarried, and he eventually began molesting his 10-year-old stepbrother. Between the ages of 17 and 19, Dodd worked at a Christian music camp, and here he would go on to molest at least a dozen of the young campers, both boys and girls. He once attempted to abduct 3 young girls, and they reported him to the police. Now, he even admitted directly to the police that he was trying to abduct and molest them. However, he was not arrested, prosecuted, or incarcerated. They just let him go on his merry way. At age 20, Wesley enlisted in the Navy and seemingly had a bright and promising future. He scored well on all of his testing, he was in the top 10% of his class, and he was put on submarine duty, which eventually docked out of Bangor, Washington. And unable to control his impulses, he would go on to molest multiple young children who lived on the base, on the military base. Trying to extend his area and not get caught, he began taking trips to Seattle to the local movie theater in order to find victims. He believed that he could go and hang out where the kids did, and that would be arcades at that time, in the mid-70s. So he would hang around the arcades and then offer the children money, sometimes up to $50, to engage in sexual acts with him. And he was finally arrested after being caught with an 11-year-old boy in a movie theater bathroom. But the charges against him were dropped, so again, he fell off the radar. On December 30th, 1982, at the age of 21, Dodd was caught trying to molest a child on the military base in Bangor, Washington, and he was discharged from the Navy for, quote, indecent liberties. And he was arrested and put in jail for 17 days in order to undergo counseling. No jail time. No official lengthy jail time. A year later, in May of 1984, he was once again arrested for child molestation, and he was given a 1-year suspended sentence. Again, no long-term jail time. The next year, 1985, Wesley was briefly living in Idaho, and you guessed it, he was arrested for molesting a 10-year-old boy. This time, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, but guess what? He only served 4 months. After the next 2 years, Dodd admitted to molesting at least 25 to 30 more young male victims. At the age of 25, he began having a sexual relationship with a female coworker, whose son he was also raping in secret. He ended up moving to Seattle at this time, and later he would go on to recount, quote, "Now, when I go to Seattle, I learned I was less likely to be reported for molestation than for an attempt. I decided that from now on, I would be a little bit more forceful. I would no longer accept no as an answer to my requests." In Seattle, during this time, while he was 25 years old, he later claimed to have molested between 25 and 30 additional children. It was also here where his impulses took a darker turn. He later said, quote, "The more I thought about it, the more exciting the idea of murder sounded. I planned many ways to kill a boy. Then I started thinking of torture, castration, and even cannibalism.
I was afraid of going back to jail again. But I still needed to go out west. I didn't want the kid to be able to report it or give a description or anything because I knew I'd go back to jail. So I started thinking that I would have to kill to keep him quiet. And the killing part in my mind became as exciting as the molesting was."
At the age of 26, while working as a security guard at a construction site, Dodd finally picked out his first victim that he had planned to murder. It was an 8-year-old son of one of the company employees. He was discovered while trying to lure the child away, and the police were called. The child managed to go home, say that he wanted to get a toy, told his mom about Dodd, and police were called. Again, another molestation charge, another obvious attempt at abduction, and he received another suspended sentence and only spent 118 days in jail. By the age of 27, Dodd moved to Vancouver, Washington, and he started working at a place called Pack Paper, and he told his coworkers that he was recently divorced and that his child had died of crib death. He noticed a park nearby his work. In a journal that he kept, he wrote, quote, "If I can get it home, I'll have more time for various types of rape rather than one quickie before a murder." A few days later, on September 4th, 1989, Wesley Allen Dodd returned to David Douglas Park and saw Billy and Cole Near riding their bicycles.
I started looking for places where there might be kids playing alone. With the Near boys, I just walked up to them. I had decided that I was going to kill that day. At times I felt a little bad about it, and I just tried to block that out of my mind. But then suddenly I realized I'm thinking about killing again. Just all of a sudden I'm thinking about that, and it pushes away any of the bad feelings I may have had.
He demanded that they get off their bikes and follow him. He said that he had a surprise for them. They did, and as soon as the trio made it into a clearing, Dodd stabbed Billy in the stomach multiple times. He then stabbed Cole in the shoulder, side, and rib cage. Unfortunately, the boys died before they could give police any identifying information. They died there in the park. Their bodies were found early the next morning as police were searching the park after their parents reported them missing that evening. Apparently, the scene was very grisly. Getting away with two murders made Dodd feel invincible. In late October, he returned to the park and saw 4-year-old Leah Sully. He abducted him and took him back to his apartment.
I kept trying to be his friend the whole time, even though I was molesting him, raping him. He was a real nice little boy.
He molested him throughout that first night. The next day, he took Lee to the local Kmart to buy him a toy. And Lee was distraught and wondering about his parents and older brother, saying that they missed him. They wanted to know where he was. And the Kmart employees, overhearing this conversation, were concerned and felt like something was really, really off. But Dodd soothed Lee and told the employees that he was taking care of his nephew. That seemed to soothe the employees, and he was able to leave the Kmart with him. He then took Lee to the local McDonald's where they got food. So he was wide out in the open, and Vancouver is not the largest, city or town, so he was very, very bold for doing that. Returning back to the apartment, Lee was sexually abused throughout night two, and then Dodd wrote in his journal. He was more or less writing out an internal debate that he had raging on whether or not to kill Lee, and ways that he could torture him as well. And it seems as though he later talked about how he really actually wanted, at the end of the day, to let Lee go, that he wanted to let him back out at the park. But because Vancouver and the area was such a small town, he was afraid that Lee would be able to identify him if they ran into each other one day, that someone would see him dropping Lee off. He decided that he had to kill him. So at one point in the middle of that night, he rolled over and whispered into this little boy's ear, "I'm going to kill you tomorrow." And that sent Lee into a crying fit. And then Wesley said, "No, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to. We're going to go get more toys tomorrow." And then Lee went to sleep. Early the next morning, Dodd strangled him to death while he was sleeping. And then he cleared out a small closet that he had in his room, and he hung the boy and took pictures of him. He hid his small body in a fort of blankets and pillows in the back of the closet and then left for work for the day. In his journal entry that day, he wrote, quote, "I'll figure out a way to dump the garbage." He disposed of Lee's body near Vancouver Lake, taking his underwear as a trophy and stashing them in a briefcase under his bed. Lee's body was found 2 days later by pheasant hunters. His parents were obviously inconsolable. Police started a massive investigation. Now we had three dead missing children in Vancouver, and they believed that the perpetrator would be at Lee Aselli's funeral, but Wesley Allen Dodd was not. He was at home building a homemade torture rack. He was using cords and cables and rope and wood. He decided to keep himself away because multiple people in the park had seen him with Cole and Billy near when he murdered the first two brothers. And a fairly accurate sketch had been made and aired to the local news and released out into both print and visual media. So he was trying to lay low at this time. The next month, Dodd decided to attack again, and he went back to using his old tactic of the movie theater. This time, he traveled to Camas, Washington, a town 20 minutes or so outside of Vancouver. He searched for the family-friendly movie listings and then went into a theater. He saw 6-year-old James Kirk. He waited until James went to the restroom and then grabbed him and made a mad dash for the car. But James was not having it. He screamed, yelled, kicked, and clawed. And he was saying, "Help, help," and he told everyone around him that the man was going to hurt him. The theater employees were obviously concerned and horrified. Again, Wesley tried the, "I'm taking care of my son, sorry, it's okay, son, it's okay, we'll get you out of here." Almost getting to his car, James was able to kick himself free and escape, and he ran back towards the movie theater. A manager from the movie theater was out on the sidewalk and was able to take him back to safety. But William Graves, the boyfriend of James Kirk's mother, was also at the movies with the family that day. And when he heard the commotion and James told him what had happened, he went after Wesley Allen Dodd. Now, fortunately, in some sort of cosmic interference or coincidence, Wesley Dodd's car had broken down right around the corner. And after getting the description of him and knowing what he was looking for, William approached him and pretended to be a helpful citizen, but then immediately put him in a headlock and brought him back to the theater to wait for police. The police were immediately dispatched to Wesley Dodd's apartment. They found a whole host of different things. They found the homemade torture rack that he had been working on, which had not been used. They found belts, knives, ropes, and the ropes from Lee Aselli were still hanging around the headboard and the footboard. However, the most disturbing evidence was in the briefcase under Wesley Allen Dodd's bed. And this is a direct quote from an article on this case, which will be in our case notes on our website, quote, "The first thing investigators noticed when they unlatched the briefcase was Lee's folded Ghostbusters underwear. They found Dodd's diaries, which painstakingly recounted his assaults and plans for future murders. Dodd had neatly organized the articles pertaining to the Near and Aselli cases and had systematically arranged his notes on the crimes, divided into separate envelopes titled Incident 1, Incident 2, and Incident 3. A photo album with the words Family Memories on the cover functioned as Dodd's pornographic collection, which included images of Christ as a baby from iconographic paintings. It also contained advertising images of children in underwear. There were Polaroids of Dodd naked, Dodd assaulting Lee, and pictures taken of Lee after he had died, including one of the little boy hanging in the closet. Wesley Allen Dodd was charged with aggravated first-degree murder in the deaths of Cole and Billy Near and Lee Aselli. He was also charged with attempted kidnapping of 6-year-old James Kirk. At first, he pleaded not guilty to all charges, but later changed his plea to guilty. And during his trial, he stood in front of a judge eventually and confessed to in detail, in graphic detail, to all crimes. He also admitted that all crimes had been premeditated. The prosecution called for the death penalty and the jury ended up agreeing. At his sentencing, Dodd told the court, quote, "I must be executed before I have an opportunity to escape or kill someone within the prison. If I do escape, I promise you I will kill and rape and enjoy every minute of it." He decided that he wanted to hang. And this is a method of execution that at that point had not been in use or done since 1965. It was considered barbaric. Now, the ACLU, against Dodd's wishes, actually fought to prevent the hanging from taking place entirely. They said that it was an unusually cruel method of execution that should not even be on the table. But Dodd won, and that enabled him to reject any further and future appeals. So his execution date was moved up considerably. Now, while waiting for death, Dodd did countless hundreds of interviews and wrote manuals for children, like little booklets for children, on how to identify pedophiles such as himself. He did interviews with CNN, ABC, NBC, Sally Jesse Raphael, countless news stations, print media outlets.
I said there's times I think about what I've done. I think about some of the things the boys said before they died, and that's real hard to think about. But other times I just try to put everything out of my mind.
Do you look forward to dying?
In a way, yeah. I think it'd be a relief. I don't have to think about all these things anymore. And I know that's the only way I can guarantee I'm not going to hurt anybody else. Right now I'd sit here and say I don't want to, but I know it'll happen.
If you look online anywhere, he wrote an ungodly amount of letters to pen pals, and you can actually buy or see a lot of these letters on serial killer memorabilia sites. On January 5th, 1993, Wesley Allen Dodd was executed by hanging in Vancouver, Washington at the age of 31. And his last words that he gave before he was executed were, quote, "I was once asked by somebody, I don't remember who, if there was any way sex offenders could be stopped. I said no, I was wrong." And I have to say, guys, that was a rough case to research. That was a really, really tough case. The amount of victims that he had when he was still in the molestation phase, it's estimated that he had somewhere, because police and psychiatrists believed him, but they put his victim range upwards of 300 children that he had sexually abused. And that was either from exposing himself or physical touching. It's just so heinously sad. The justice system failed so many times in this case. Family knowing, his dad especially, knowing that he was doing this stuff and not reporting him to police authorities or getting him counseling, being arrested, not getting help, no lengthy prison sentences. I mean, society as a whole failed with this one. But that is the case that we have for Vancouver, Washington, and this is where we will begin our road trip. Wanted to get that out there. Again, if you want to hear a Portland, Oregon-specific case, girl who Jackie knew very, very well, close friend, who was unfortunately, whose life was ended prematurely, that is in our Patreon. But yeah, as we make our way through our road trip, we will be picking up cases and discovering cases, and most likely by the time we land at Tennessee, we will have a whole list of cases ready to go and episodes to record. So it's very cool to look at places. I mean, how many of you guys do that? How many of you read about a case or travel somewhere, read about a case, and then you want to see where it took place, the building, the field, the property? So that's kind of what we're angling for, and we will have a whole host of episodes to record for you once we land. Again, don't forget you can check us out on wesawthedevil.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, find us at wesawthedevil. And if you're enjoying the show, it's not too late to get December's postcards. We have a cool one for December where you get a physical postcard in the mail from a particular city, state, or country. And then in the very last day of the month, we will actually drop an episode on it. So it's like a fun little case of the month type of thing that we do. You can get true crime merch, stickers, ad-free episodes, which ads are annoying, I know, so you can get them ad-free with our Patreon. And then once we get settled, we plan on doing a lot more for the podcast, live streams, get more video content going. And really, we want to put out the show that our listeners want. we want to hear from you. You can pick our topics, pick the cases, help us choose that. And we have a really, really cool Facebook group for it too. So again, if you like the show and you want to back it, check us out on Patreon. That's patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. And because we will be on the road next week, the episodes, we probably will only have one episode next week. So I apologize for that, but we will be en route driving almost 2,500 miles. So thanks again for listening, guys. Until next crime.